now that she has served her purpose. I must think of a suitable way to end her life. Where is she at the moment? As the truck began its slow journey back along the tiny desert path, with Aziz taking his turn behind the wheel and Cohen in the back with Madame Bertha, Scott felt the atmosphere inside the cab had changed. When they pulled off the highway to rest, he still believed they were in no real danger. But the grim silence of morning made him suddenly aware of the task they had set themselves. They had Kratz to thank for the original idea, and mixed with his particular cocktail of imagination, discipline, courage, and the assumption that no one knew what they were up to, Scott felt they had a better than even chance of getting away with it, especially now that they knew exactly where the declaration was situated. When they reached the main road, Aziz jokingly asked, "Right or left?" Scott said, "Left," but Aziz turned dutifully right. As they traveled along the highway towards Baghdad, the sun shone from a cloudless sky that would have delighted any tourist bored, although the burned-out tanks and the craters in the road might not have been considered obvious attractions. No one spoke as the miles sped by. There was no need for them to go over the plans another time. That would be like an Olympian training on the morning of a race, either too late or no longer of any value. For the last 10 miles, they joined an expressway that was equal to anything they might have found in Germany. As they crossed a newly reconstructed bridge over the Euphrates, Scott began to wonder how close he was to Hannah, and whether he could get himself into the foreign ministry without alerting Kratz, let alone the Iraqis. When they reached the outskirts of Baghdad, with its glistening skyscrapers and modern buildings, they could have been entering any major city in the world, until they saw the people. There were lines of cars at gas pumps, in a land where the main asset was oil, but their length was dwarfed only by the lines for food. All four of them could see that sanctions were biting, however much Saddam denied it. As they drove nearer to the city center, along the road that passed under the Al-Nasser, the massive archway of two crossed swords gripped by casts of Saddam's hands, there was no need to direct Aziz to the Ministry of Industry. He wished he still lived in Baghdad, but he hadn't entered the city since his father had been executed for his part in the failed coup of 1987. Looking out of the window at his countrymen, he could still smell their fear in his nostrils. When Aziz saw the Ministry of Industry building looming up ahead of him, he pointed it out to Scott, who remembered the facade from the mass of photographs supplied by Kratz. But Scott's eyes had moved up to the gun turrets on top of the foreign ministry, a mere stone's throw away. Aziz brought the truck to a halt, 100 yards beyond the entrance to the ministry. "I'll be as quick as I can," Scott said as he jumped out of the cab and headed back towards the building. As he climbed the steps to the ministry, he didn't see a man in a window of the building opposite who was speaking on the telephone to General Hamil.
"The truck has stopped about 100 yards beyond the ministry. A tall, fair-haired man who was in the front of the vehicle is now entering the building, but the other three, including Kratz, have remained with the safe."
Scott pushed through the swing doors and strolled past two guards who looked as if they didn't move more than a few feet every day. He walked over to the information desk and joined the shortest of three lines. The one-handed clock above the desk indicated that it was approximately 9:30. It took another 15 minutes before Scott reached the counter. He explained to the girl that his name was Bernstrom and that he needed to see Mr. Kajami.
"Do you have an appointment?" she asked.
"No," said Scott. "We called from Jordan to warn him that a safe the government had ordered was on its way to Baghdad. He asked us to inform him the moment it arrived."
"I will see if he's in," said the receptionist.
Scott waited, staring up at a massive portrait of Saddam Hussein in uniform holding a Kalashnikov. It dominated the otherwise blank gray walls of the reception area. The girl listened carefully to whoever it was on the other end of the phone before saying,
"Someone will be down to see you in a few minutes."
She turned her attention to the next person in the line. Scott hung around for another 30 minutes before a tall, thin man wearing a smart Western suit stepped out of the elevator and walked over to him.
"Mr. Bernstrom?"
"Yes," said Scott as he swung around to face the man.
"Good morning.
he said confidently in English. "I am Mr. Ibrahim, Mr. Kajami's personal assistant. How can I help you?"
"I have brought a safe from Sweden," said Scott. "It was ordered by the ministry some years ago, but due to the UN sanctions, couldn't be delivered any earlier. We were told that when we reached Baghdad, we should report to Mr. Kajami."
"Do you have any papers to verify your claim?"
Scott removed a file from his bag and showed Mr. Ibrahim its contents. The man read through each document slowly until he came to the letter signed by the president. He read no further. Looking up, he asked,
"May I see this safe, Mr. Bernstrom?"
"Certainly," said Scott. "Please follow me." He led the official out onto the street and took him over to the truck. Cohen stared down at them. When Kratz gave the order, he whipped the tarpaulin off the safe so that the civil servant could inspect Madame Bertha for himself. Scott was fascinated by the fact that those passing in the street didn't give the safe a second look. If anything, they quickened their pace. Fear manifested itself among these people by their lack of curiosity.
"Please return with me, Mr. Bernstrom," said Ibrahim.
Scott accompanied him back to the reception area, where he left without another word. Scott waited for another 30 minutes before Ibrahim came back.
"You are to take this safe to Victory Square, where you will see a barrier with a tank in front of a large white building. They are expecting you."
Scott was about to ask where Victory Square was when Ibrahim turned and walked away. He went back to the truck and joined Kratz and Aziz in the front before passing on the news. Aziz didn't need to be told the way.
"No special treatment there, I'm glad to see," said Kratz.
Scott nodded his agreement as Aziz eased the truck back into the road. The traffic was much heavier now. Trucks and cars were honking their horns, managing to move only a few inches at a time. "It must be an accident," said Scott, until they turned the corner and saw the three bodies hanging from a makeshift gallows. A man wearing an expensive designer suit, a woman perhaps a little younger, and another much older woman. It was hard to be certain, with their heads shaven. Mr. Kajami sat at his desk, dialed the number that had been passed to him, and waited.
"Deputy Foreign Minister's Office, Miss Saib speaking."
"This is the Minister of Industry calling. Could you put me through to the Deputy Foreign Minister?"
"I'm afraid he's out of the office at the moment, Mr. Kajami. Shall I ask him to return your call, or would you like to leave a message?"
"I will leave a message, but perhaps he could also call me when he gets back."
"Certainly, Minister."
"Could you let him know that the safe has arrived from Sweden and can therefore be crossed off the sanctions list?"
There was a long pause.
"Are you still there, Miss Saib?"
"Yes. I was just writing down what you said, sir."
"If he needs to see the relevant forms, we still have them at the ministry, but if it's the safe he wants to check on, it's already on its way to the Bath headquarters."
"I understand, sir. I'll see he gets the message just as soon as he comes in."
"Thank you, Miss Saib."
Kajami replaced the phone on the hook, glanced across his desk at the Deputy Foreign Minister, and smiled. Chapter 29. Aziz brought the truck to a halt in front of a tank. A few soldiers were moving around, but there didn't appear to be a great deal of activity.
"I was expecting a bigger show of force than this," said Kratz. "It's the Ba'ath Party headquarters, after all."
"Saddam's probably at the palace, or even out of Baghdad," suggested Aziz, as two soldiers advanced towards the truck. The first one shouted, "Out!"
and they obeyed slowly. Once all four of them were on the ground, the soldier ordered them to stand a few yards away from the truck, while a couple of other soldiers jumped up on the back and removed the tarpaulin.
"This one's a major,"
whispered Aziz, as a portly man covered in battle ribbons and carrying a mobile phone advanced towards them. He stopped and looked up at the safe suspiciously before turning to Kratz and introducing himself as Major Saeed.
"Open,"
was all he added. Kratz pointed to Scott, who climbed up onto the back of the truck while several more soldiers surrounded the vehicle to watch him perform the opening ceremony. Once Scott had pulled the great door open, the major joined him on the back of the truck, but not until one of the soldiers had given him a hand up. He stood a pace back and ordered two of his men to go inside. They appeared apprehensive at first, but once they had entered the safe, they began touching the sides and even jumping up to try to reach the roof. A few moments later, Saeed joined them and banged the walls with his swagger stick. He then stepped back out, jumped heavily off the truck, and turned towards Scott.
"Now we wait for a crane," he said, sounding a little more friendly.
He dialed a number on the phone. Cohen climbed into the cab and sat behind the wheel, the keys still in the ignition, while Aziz remained on the back with the safe. Scott and Kratz leaned against a wall, trying to appear bored, while having a conversation on the alternatives they now faced.
"We must find some way of getting into the building ahead of the safe," said Kratz.
Scott nodded his agreement. The clock in Victory Square had struck 12:30 before Aziz spotted the tall, thin structure progressing slowly around the massive statue of Saddam. The four of them watched as soldiers ran out into the street to hold up the flow of traffic and allow the vast crane to continue its progress uninterrupted. Scott explained to the major that the truck now needed to be moved to a position opposite the front door. He agreed without a phone call. When the truck was parked exactly where Scott wanted it, Major Saeed finally conceded that the doors would have to come off their hinges if they were ever going to get the safe and its dolly inside the building. This time he did make a phone call, and to Scott's question, "How long?" he simply shrugged his shoulders and replied,
"Must wait."
Scott was determined to use the "must wait" period, and explained to Major Saeed that he needed to walk the route that the safe would travel once they had entered the building. The major hesitated, made a further phone call, held on for some time before he received an answer, and then, pointing to Scott, said,
"You only."
Scott left Kratz to organize the crane as it prepared to lift the safe off the truck and followed the major into the building. The first thing that Scott noticed as he walked down the carpeted corridor was its width and solid feel. Every few paces there were soldiers lounging against the wall who sprang to attention the moment they saw Major Saeed. At the end of the corridor was an elevator. The major produced a key and turned it in a lock on the wall. The doors of the elevator opened slowly. It struck Scott that the size of the safe must have been determined by the width of the elevator. He doubted if there would be much more than an inch to spare all around once they had succeeded in getting Madame Bertha on board. The major pressed a button marked -6, which Scott noted was as far as they could go. The elevator dropped slowly down. When the doors opened, Scott followed Major Saeed into a long corridor. This time he had the feeling that the passageway had been built to survive an earthquake. They came to a halt outside a pair of heavy, reinforced doors guarded by two soldiers carrying rifles. Saeed asked a question, and both guards shook their heads.
"The chamber is empty, so we can go straight through," he explained,
then proceeded to unlock the door. Scott followed him into the council chamber. His eyes searched quickly around the room. The first thing he saw on the far wall was another massive portrait of Saddam, this time in a dark, double-breasted suit. Then he spotted one of the red alarm buttons next to a light switch that Kratz had warned him about. The major hurried on through the chamber, giving the impression of a man who hadn't the right to be there, while Scott went as slowly as he felt he could get away with. And then he saw it, just for a moment, and his heart sank. The Declaration of Independence was nailed to the wall, a corner torn and some of the signatures looking distinctly blurred. The major unlocked the far door, and Scott reluctantly followed him into the adjoining corridor. They continued for only a few more paces before coming to a halt in front of a massive recess of inlaid brick that Scott didn't need to measure to realize had been purpose-built in anticipation of the arrival of the safe. Scott took some time measuring the space as he tried to think of how he could get a longer look at the declaration. After a few minutes, Major Saeed tapped him on the shoulder with his swagger stick and indicated that it was time for them to return to the courtyard. Scott reluctantly followed him back down the short corridor and into the council chamber, which the major scurried through while Scott lingered to measure the doors. He was pleased to discover that they would have to be taken off their hinges. He stood a pace back as if considering the problem. The major returned and slapped the side of his leg with his swagger stick, muttering something under his breath that Scott suspected wasn't altogether flattering. Scott stole a glance to the right and confirmed his worst fears. Even if he were able to exchange the two documents, it would take an even greater genius than Dollar Bill to repair the damage that Saddam had already inflicted.
"Come, come, we must go," said the major.
"And so must these doors," said Scott, and turning, added, "and those two as well," pointing to the pair at the other end of the chamber. But Major Saeed was already striding off down the long corridor towards the open elevator. Hannah put the phone down and tried to stop herself trembling. They had warned her many times at Herzliya that however tough you think you are and however well-trained you've been, you will still tremble. She checked her watch. Her lunch break was due in 20 minutes, and although she rarely left the building during the day except on official business, she knew she could no longer sit in that office and just wait for events to happen around her. The deputy foreign minister had left for the palace at 8 that morning and had told her not to expect him back until 5 at the earliest. A muscle in her cheek twitched as she began to type out the Minister of Industry's message. For 15 minutes, she sat at her desk and planned how the hour could be best spent. As soon as she was clear in her mind what needed to be done, she picked up her phone and asked a girl on the switchboard to cover her calls during the lunch break. Hannah put on her glasses, left the room, and walked quickly down the corridor, remaining close to the wall with her head bowed so that those passing didn't give her a second look. She took the stairs rather than the elevator, slipped across the hall past reception, through the swing doors, and out onto the steps of the foreign ministry.
"Saeb's just left the building," said a voice from the other side of the road into a mobile phone. "She's going in the direction of Victory Square."
Hannah continued walking towards the square. The crowds were so large and noisy that she feared another public hanging must have taken place. When she reached the end of the road and turned the corner, she averted her eyes as she made a path between those who were standing, staring, some even laughing at the spectacle. "Quite a high-up official," someone joked. Another more serious voice said that he had heard he was a diplomat recently back from America who had been caught with his fingers in the till. A third, an elderly woman, wept when someone suggested that the other two were the man's innocent mother and sister. Once Hannah could see the barrier, she slowed her pace. She stopped and stared across the road at the Ba'ath Party headquarters. She was pleased to be hidden in such a large crowd, even if it did occasionally obscure her view.
"She's facing the Ba'ath Party headquarters. Everyone else is looking in the opposite direction."
Hannah's eyes settled on a truck that was surrounded by soldiers, and then she saw the massive safe that was perched on the back of the vehicle and the two young men who were attaching large coils of steel to its base. One was Middle Eastern in appearance, the other vaguely European. And then she saw Kratz. Or was it Kratz? Whoever it was disappeared behind the far side of the truck. She waited for the man to reappear. When he did, a few moments later, she was left in no doubt that it was the Mossad leader. She realized that she could not wait around in such a public place for much longer and decided to return to her office and consider what needed to be done next. She gave Kratz one last look as a group of cleaners came out of the building, walked across the tarmac, and passed by the barrier without any of the soldiers paying them the slightest attention.
"She's on the move again, but she doesn't seem to be returning to the ministry."
The man on the mobile phone listened for a moment and then replied,
"I don't know, but I'll follow her and report back."
Hannah began to walk away from Victory Square just as Major Saeed and Scott emerged from the building into the courtyard.
Honor Among Thieves, Cassette 8.
When Scott stepped back into the courtyard, he was pleased to see that Kratz had already got the crane into position to lift the safe off the truck. Aziz and Cohen were fastening long steel coils around the body of Madame Bertha, while the specially constructed trolley, of which Mr. Peterson was so proud, had been placed on the ground between the front door and the side of the truck. Scott looked up at the crane, which was taller than the building itself, and back down at the operator sitting in his wide cab near the base. Once Cohen and Aziz had jumped off the truck, Kratz gave the operator the thumbs up. Scott pointed at the safe and beckoned to Kratz, who walked over, looking puzzled. He thought the operation was going rather well. "What's the problem?" he asked. Scott continued pointing at the safe, and with exaggerated movements indicated how he thought it would have to be moved, while whispering to Kratz, "I've seen the declaration." He moved to the other side of the safe. Kratz followed, now also pretending to take a close interest in the safe. "Great news," said Kratz. "So where is it?" "The news is not so great," said Scott. "What do you mean?" asked Kratz anxiously. "It's in the council chamber, exactly where Hannah said it would be. But it's nailed to the wall," replied Scott.
"Nailed to the wall?" said Kratz under his breath.
"Yes, and it looks as if it's beyond repair," said Scott, as he heard the crunch of a gear shifting into place. He watched as the steel cords tightened, followed by a raucous revving of the engine. But Madame Bertha refused to budge an inch. The revving noise became even louder a second time, but Madame Bertha remained unmoved by their solicitations. The operator pushed the long gear lever forward another notch and tried a third time. Finally, Bertha rose an inch off the back of the truck, swaying gently from side to side. Some of the soldiers started to cheer, but they stopped immediately when the major turned to stare in their direction. Kratz nodded, and Cohen ran across the tarmac and lowered the tailgate before getting into the cab and jumping behind the wheel of the truck. He switched on the engine, pushed the gear lever into first, and moved the vehicle slowly forward until the safe was left dangling in midair. Aziz and Kratz then pushed the trolley a few yards across the tarmac so that it was directly below the dangling safe. Kratz gave the thumbs up a second time, and the crane operator slowly began lowering the 5 tons of steel, inch by inch, until it came to rest on the trolley, causing the large rubber wheels to compress abruptly. The safe now rested in front of the double doors, waiting for the carpenter to arrive before it could progress on its inward journey. The major shrugged his shoulders even before Kratz had mouthed the question. As Cohen backed the truck into a parking space designated by the major, an Iraqi, dressed in a dishdash and a red and white kafia, and carrying a tool bag, appeared at the barrier. Once the guards had thoroughly checked the tool bag, tipping all its contents out onto the ground, they allowed him through. The carpenter gathered up his tools, took one look at the safe, another at the double doors, and understood immediately why his boss had described the problem as urgent. Scott stood back and watched the craftsman as he began to unscrew the hinges on one of the doors.
"So where's Dollar Bill's counterfeit at the moment?" asked Kratz.
"Still in my bag," said Scott. "I'm going to have to do some work on it, or they'll spot the difference the moment I've exchanged it for the original."
"Agreed," said Kratz. "You'd better get on with it while the carpenter's working on the door. Meanwhile, I'll try and keep the major occupied."
Kratz sauntered over to the carpenter and started chatting to him while Scott disappeared into the front of the truck carrying his bag. Once the major saw what Kratz was doing, he ran across to join them. Scott stared through the cab window as he extracted Dollar Bill's copy from the cylinder and tried to recall where the main damage was on the original. First he made a tear in the top right-hand corner. Then he spat on the names of John Adams and Robert Treat Payne. After he had studied his handiwork, he decided he hadn't gone far enough, and placing the copy on the floor, he rubbed the soles of his shoes gently over the surface. He glanced up to see the major ordering Kratz to let the carpenter get on with his job. Kratz shrugged his shoulders as Scott rolled up the copy of the declaration and returned it to the cylinder before sliding it down a specially sewn, long, thin pocket on the inside of his trouser leg. A perfect fit. A few moments later, the carpenter got off his knees and smiled to show he had completed his task. At the major's command, 4 soldiers stepped forward and removed the doors. They carried them a few paces away and leaned them up against an outside wall. The major ordered several more soldiers to push the trolley as Scott guided Madame Bertha through the doorway. Kratz and Aziz tried to follow, but the major waved an arm firmly to indicate that only Scott could enter the building. It was Scott's turn to shrug his shoulders. Inch by inch, they eased the dolly down the long corridor. The elevator doors had been left open, but it still took 40 hands to lever the 5 tons of metal safely inside. Scott knew from his research that this part of the building had been built to survive a nuclear attack, but he wondered if the elevator would ever recover from having to carry the 5-ton safe down 6 floors. He was only thankful that Madame Bertha was going down, not up. The elevator doors slowly closed, and the major quickly led Scott through a side door and down the back stairs, followed by a dozen soldiers. When they reached the basement, the doors of the elevator were already open, and Madame Bertha stood there, majestically waiting. The major pointed to the floor with his swagger stick. 10 of the soldiers fell to their knees and began pulling the trolley inch by inch until they finally managed to coax it into the corridor. The elevator was then sent up to -5, and 6 of the soldiers ran back up the stairs, jumped into the empty elevator, and returned to the basement so they could push the safe from the other side. The carpenter had already removed the first set of doors they would encounter when the safe entered the council chamber, but was still working on the second set when the dolly reached the entrance. The delay gave Scott an opportunity to supervise the moving of the large table up against the side wall and the placing of the chairs on the table so that the safe would have a clear passage into the far corridor. As he went back and forth, Scott had several opportunities to stare at the declaration, even study the spelling of the word, British. He quickly realized that the parchment was in an even worse condition than he had thought. Once the doors were finally removed, the soldiers began pushing the safe across the chamber and out into the short corridor on the last few yards of its journey. When they had reached the end of the corridor opposite the specially prepared recess, Scott supervised the last few inches of its move until they could push the 5 tons of steel no further. Madame Bertha had finally come to her resting place against the far wall. Scott smiled, and Major Saeed made another phone call. The old woman explained to Hannah that the next shift was to be at 3 o'clock that afternoon, and they would be expected to have the council chamber ready for the meeting that was to take place at 6 the following day. They hadn't been able to do a proper job on the first shift that morning because of that safe. Hannah had followed the cleaners, watching as they peeled off one by one and went their separate ways. She selected an old woman carrying the heaviest bags and offered to help her across the road. They quickly got into conversation, and Hannah continued to carry the bags all the way to her front door, explaining that she only lived a few streets away.
"Come inside, my dear," the old lady said.
"Thank you," replied Hannah, feeling more like the wolf than Little Red Riding Hood. Slipping a small whiskey into the old woman's coffee had proved harmless enough, and it certainly loosened her tongue. 2 Valium dropped in the cleaner's second coffee ensured that it would be several hours before she woke. Mossad had taught Hannah 5 different ways of breaking into a car, a hotel room, a briefcase, even a small safe, so a drugged old woman's handbag was no great challenge. She removed the special pass and slipped out of the house.
"She's now heading back in the direction of the ministry," said the voice into the mobile phone. "We've checked the old woman. She passed out and probably won't come around until this time tomorrow. The only thing that's been taken is her security pass."
When Hannah arrived back at her desk, there was no sign that the deputy foreign minister had returned, so she checked with the switchboard. There had only been 3 calls. 2 said they would call back tomorrow, and the 3rd didn't leave a message. Hannah replaced the handset and typed out a note explaining that she had gone home as she wasn't certain whether the deputy foreign minister would be returning that day. As long as he didn't check his messages until after 5 o'clock, there would be no reason for him to become suspicious. in the privacy of her little room, Hannah exchanged her office clothes for the traditional black abaya with a pushy covering her face. She checked herself in the mirror before once again leaving the building, silently and anonymously. "I'm almost sure it's her coming out of the ministry," said the voice into the mobile phone. "But she's changed into traditional dress and is no longer wearing glasses. She's heading towards Victory Square again. I'll keep you briefed." Hannah was back in Victory Square before the first cleaner was expected to arrive for work. Although the crowd was now smaller, she was still able to remain inconspicuous. She looked across the road towards the courtyard. The safe was no longer to be seen, and the crane, too, had disappeared. The truck was now backed up against the wall. Hannah strained to see if Kratz was one of the figures sitting in the front of the truck, but she couldn't penetrate the haze of smoke. Hannah turned her attention to a building she had never entered but felt she knew well. A full-scale plan of each floor was attached to a board in the operations room of Mossad's headquarters in Herzliya, and you couldn't take the second paper of any exam on Iraq without being able to draw every floor of the building in detail. Information was added all the time from the strangest sources, escaped refugees, former diplomats, ex-cabinet ministers who were Kurds or Shiites, even the former British Prime Minister, Edward Heath. The first cleaner arrived a few minutes before 3, presented her pass, and then hurried across the tarmac before disappearing into a side door of the building. The second appeared a few moments later and followed the same procedure. When Hannah spotted the third making her way along the far side of the sidewalk, she slipped across the road and filed in behind her as she walked towards the barrier. "She's crossed the road, reached the barrier, and the guard is now checking her pass," said the voice into the mobile phone. "As instructed, they've let her through. She's now walking across the tarmac and following another woman through the side door. She's in. The door's closed. We've got her. Now, you, open the safe," said Major Saeed. Scott swiveled the dials to their coded numbers, and the first bulb turned green. The Major was impressed. Scott then placed the palm of his hand on the white square, and a few seconds later the middle bulb turned green. The Major was mesmerized. Scott leaned forward and spoke into the voice box, and the third light turned green. The Major was speechless. Scott pulled the handle, and the door swung open. He jumped inside and immediately extracted the cardboard tube from the inside of his trouser leg. The Major spotted it at once and flew into a rage. Scott quickly flicked off the cap, took out the poster of Saddam Hussein, and unpeeled it, letting the backing paper fall to the ground before he strolled to the far side of the safe and fixed the portrait of Saddam to the wall. A smile returned to the Major's face as Scott bent down, rolled up the backing paper, and slid it into the tube. "Now I teach you," said Scott.
"No, no, not me," said Major Saeed. He held his phone up in the air and said, "We must return to the yard."
Scott felt like swearing as he stepped out of the safe, dropping the tube and allowing it to roll across the floor to the darkest corner. The plan he had so carefully prepared with Kratz would no longer be possible. He reluctantly left the open safe and joined the Major as he marched quickly towards the council chamber, this time not allowing Scott any opportunity to hold him up. Once Hannah had joined the other cleaners inside the building, she told them that her mother had been taken ill and that she had been sent to cover for her. She tried to assure them that it was not the first time she had done so, and was surprised when they asked no questions. She assumed that they were fearful of being involved with a stranger. Hannah picked up a box of cleaning equipment and made her way down the back stairs. The plan displayed on the walls at Herzliya was proving impressively accurate, even if nobody had managed the exact number of steps to the basement. When she reached the door that led into the bottom corridor, she could hear voices coming from the direction of the council chamber. Whoever it was must be heading for the elevator. Hannah backed up against the wall so she could just see them through the thick pane of wire mesh glass in the center of the door. The two men passed. Hannah didn't recognize the Major, but when she saw who was with him, her legs gave way and she almost collapsed. Once they were back in the courtyard, the major dialed the number. Scott strolled over to Kratz, who was standing behind the truck.
"Did you manage to switch the declaration?"
were Kratz's first words. "No, I didn't have time. It's still on the wall of the chamber."
"Damn! And the copy?"
"I left it in the tube on the floor of the safe. I couldn't risk bringing it out."
"So how are you going to get back into the building?"
asked Kratz, looking towards the major.
"You were meant to use the time..."
"I know, but it turns out he's not the one who'll be in charge of the safe. He's getting in touch with whoever it is I'll have to instruct."
"Not what we needed. I suspect that with the major our first plan would have been a lot easier," said Kratz.
"I'd better brief the others so we can work on an alternative if things go wrong again."
Scott nodded his agreement, and he and the Mossad leader strolled over to the truck where Aziz and Cohen were sitting in the cab smoking. As the colonel climbed into the front, two cigarettes were quickly stubbed out. Kratz explained why they were still waiting and warned them that this could be the professor's last chance to get back into the council chamber.
"So when he comes out next time," he explained, "we must be ready to go. With a little luck, we might still make the border by midnight."
How could he possibly be alive? Hannah thought. Hadn't she killed him? She had seen his dead body carried out of the room. She tried to organize her thoughts, which ranged from absolute joy to utter fear. She recalled her senior instructor telling her, "When you're in the front line, never be surprised by anything." She felt she now had the right to contradict him, if she was ever given the chance. Hannah pushed the door open and crept into the corridor, which was deserted except for a pair of soldiers chatting by the door of the chamber. She realized she couldn't hope to get past them and into the chamber without being questioned. With a pace to go, she was told to stop and came to a halt between them. After they had checked the cleaning box thoroughly, the one with two stripes on his arm said, "You know it's our duty to search you as well." Hannah made no comment while he bent down, lifted her long black robe, and placed his hands on her ankles. The second one let out a raucous laugh as he put his fingers around the front of her neck and began moving his hands down over her shoulders and across her breasts, while his colleague moved his hands up her legs and onto her thighs. As the first soldier reached the top of her legs, his colleague pinched her nipples. Hannah pushed them both away and stepped into the chamber. They made no attempt to follow, although their laughter increased in volume. The table had been returned to the center of the room, and the chairs casually rearranged around it. She began by straightening the table before placing the chairs at an equal distance from each other, while still trying to take in the fact that Scott was alive. But why would the CIA send him? Unless... She stared up at the massive portrait of Saddam Hussein as she straightened his chair at the head of the table. Then her eyes came to rest on the document that was nailed next to his picture. The American Declaration of Independence was fixed to the wall in exactly the place the deputy foreign minister had claimed it was. Chapter 30. Two cars swept up to the barrier and were ushered quickly through without the suggestion of a check. Scott watched carefully as a large group of soldiers surrounded the vehicles. When a tall, heavily built man stepped out of the second car, Aziz said under his breath, "General Hamil, the barber of Baghdad. He carries an unsharpened razor on his keyring." Kratz nodded. "I know his complete life history," he said, "even the name of the young lieutenant he's currently living with." Major Saeed was now standing to attention, saluting the general, and Scott didn't need to be told that this man was of a different rank and caliber than the one he had been dealing with until then. He studied the face of the man dressed in an immaculate tailored uniform with several more rows of battle ribbons than the major, wearing black leather gloves and carrying a swagger stick. It was a cruel face. The troops who stood around him were unable to disguise their fear. The major pointed to Scott and said, "You, come."
"I've got a feeling he means you," said Krutz.
Scott nodded and strolled across to join them.
"Mr. Berenstrom,"
the general said, removing the glove from his right hand.
"I am General Hamil."
Scott shook his hand.
"I am sorry to have kept you waiting. But don't let me hold you up any longer. Please show me your safe, which Major Said seems so impressed by."
Without another word, the general turned and began walking towards the building, leaving Scott with little choice but to follow. For the first time in his life, Scott was terrified. Hannah picked up a duster and some polish and began to rub in small circles on the table while taking a more careful look at the Declaration of Independence. The parchment was in such terrible condition that she doubted if it could be repaired, even if Scott were able to get it back to Washington. She peered around the door into the short corridor and spotted the safe she had seen on the truck earlier that day. It was open, but was guarded by two more thugs, chatting as much as the other two who were stationed at the door of the council chamber. Anna made her way slowly down the corridor, dusting and polishing the ledge of the wooden skirting until she was opposite the safe and had a clear view inside. She took a pace forward and peered in as if she had never seen anything like it in her life before. One of the soldiers kicked her and she fell into the safe. The inevitable raucous laughter followed. She was about to turn around and retaliate when she saw the long cardboard cylinder in one corner, almost hidden in the shadow. She leaned across and rolled it quickly towards her until it was safely under her long skirt. She wondered if she could use it to get a message to Simon. Hannah left her duster and polish on the floor of the safe, stepped out backwards, and bolted down the corridor as if to escape the guards. Once she was back in the chamber, she removed another rag from the cleaning box and began polishing the table until she was in a position where no one could see her from either passageway. She then lowered herself slowly onto her knees until she was below the table and let the cardboard tube fall to the floor in front of her. She quickly flicked off the cap to find the cylinder wasn't empty. She pulled out the parchment, unrolled it, and studied it in disbelief. A magnificent copy of the Declaration of Independence, obviously made by a craftsman, even if someone had tried to deface it. She realized immediately that Simon must have been hoping to find some way of switching the copy for the original. Kratz watched Scott follow General Hamil into the building, then walked slowly across to the truck and climbed into the cab. He stared through the front window. No one was taking any particular interest in what they were up to.
"This is too easy," he said. "Far too easy."
Cohen and Aziz looked straight ahead but didn't offer an opinion.
"If Hamil is involved, they must suspect something. The time has come for us to find out who knows what."
"What do you have in mind, sir?" asked Cohen.
"I have a feeling that our switchboard major isn't fully aware of what's going on. Either they haven't briefed him, or they think he's not up to the job."
"Or both," suggested Aziz.
Kratz nodded. "Or both. So, let's find out. Aziz, I want you and Cohen to take a stroll down to the barrier. Tell the guards that you're going for something to eat, and that you'll be back in a few minutes. If they refuse to let you through, we've got a real problem, because that will mean they know what we're up to. In which case, come back to the cab, and I'll start working on what we have to do next."
"And if they let us through?" asked Cohen.
"Get out of sight," said Kratz, "but keep in visual contact with the truck. That shouldn't be too hard with these gawking crowds. If Professor Bradley comes out with his cardboard tube, and I rest my arm on the window ledge as I'm doing now, get back here fast, because we won't want to be hanging about. And by the way, Cohen, if I'm not around for any reason, and the professor should suggest a detour to the foreign ministry, overrule him.
Your only job is to get him over the border. Cohen nodded, without a clue what the colonel was talking about. But if you spot that we're in trouble, keep well out of the way for 1 hour and then pray that the whopper works.
Understood, sir.
Take the keys with you, said Kratz. Now, get going.
Kratz stepped back down onto the tarmac, strolled over to where Major Saeed was listening to one of his interminable phone calls, and placed himself a few feet to Saeed's left as if wanting to attract his attention. At the same time, he looked over his shoulder to watch Aziz and Cohen walking towards the barrier. Kratz continued to try and attract the major's attention as he watched Aziz come to a halt at the barrier and start joking with one of the guards. A few moments later, he saw both of his men step under the barrier. Within seconds, they were lost in the crowd. Major Saeed came off the phone.
"What is the problem this time?"
he asked. Kratz took out a cigarette and asked the major for a light.
"Don't smoke,"
he said and waved him away. Kratz walked slowly back to the cab and took his place behind the steering wheel, his eyes never leaving the open doorway of the Ba'ath Party headquarters. Hannah stared at the declaration hanging on the wall. It was only a few paces away from her. She waited until she heard another roar of laughter from the soldiers before walking over to the document and quickly trying to remove the nails. Three came out with a minimum of effort, but the one at the top right-hand corner refused to budge, and the declaration continued to dangle from it. After a few more seconds, she felt she was left with no choice but to ease the document over the head of the nail. Once the parchment was in her hand, she went back to the table, placed the original on the floor, and returned quickly to attach the copy to the wall. She hardly glanced at her handiwork before she turned back to the table, knelt on the ground, and rapidly rolled up the original, replacing it in the cylinder. Once again, she tucked it under her skirt. It had been the longest 2 minutes of her life. She remained on her knees, trying to think. She knew she couldn't risk trying to get the tube out of the building, as the guards might decide to search her again. There was no alternative. She walked quickly back down the short corridor and was in the safe even before the two soldiers had stopped talking. She let the cylinder fall to the floor, then pushed it back into the darkest corner, exactly where she had first seen it. Then she picked up the duster and polish she had left behind, stepped back out of the safe and showed them to the soldiers, and ran back down the corridor towards the chamber. Hannah knew she must get out of the building as quickly as possible and somehow pass a message to Simon. And then she heard the voices. The elevator doors slid apart at the basement floor. The general stepped out into the corridor and headed towards the council chamber.
"And just how large is this safe?"
the general asked Scott. 9 feet in height, 7 feet in width, and 8 feet in depth," responded Scott immediately. "You could hold a private meeting in there if you wish to, General."
"Is that so?" said Hamil. "But I am informed this safe can only be operated by one person. Is that true?"
"That is correct, General. We followed the exact specifications your government requested."
"I am also told that this safe can withstand a nuclear attack. Is that the case?"
"Yes," replied Scott. "The safe has a 6-inch skin and would be unaffected by any explosion other than a direct hit. In any other circumstances, everything in the safe would be preserved, even if the building it was standing in was completely demolished."
"Impressive," said the general,
as the guards sprang to attention and he touched the rim of his beret with his swagger stick. He marched into the chamber and Scott followed, annoyed to find there was a woman polishing the table. He certainly didn't need her hanging around when he came back out. The general didn't even look at Hannah as he strode through the chamber. Scott glanced across at the parchment before he followed the general out of the room.
"Ah,"
Hannah heard the general say when he was still several yards from the end of the corridor.
"Pure statistics don't do your safe justice, Mr. Bernstrom."
The two soldiers remained rigidly at attention as the general studied the safe for some time before stepping inside. When he saw the cardboard tube on the floor, he bent down and picked it up. Just to protect the picture, explained Scott as he stepped in to join him. He pointed to the portrait of Saddam Hussein.
You are a thorough man, Mr. Bernstrom, said Hamil. You would have made an excellent colonel in one of my regiments.
He laughed and passed the cardboard tube over to Scott. Hannah listened intently to every word and concluded that she must get out of the building as quickly as possible and alert Kratz to what she had done. Would you like me to show you how to program the safe? She heard Scott ask as she reached the entrance of the chamber.
No, no, not me, said General Hamil. The president will be the only one who will be allowed to operate the safe.
Those were the last words Hannah heard, as she walked out of the chamber, past the guards, and continued purposefully down the long corridor. When she reached the doors that led to the staircase, she turned back to see the general striding into the chamber, and some way behind him, Scott following. He was holding the tube. Hannah wanted to scream with delight. Scott realized he would never be given a chance to carry out the switch once Saddam was in the building. When he reached the chamber, he allowed the general to get a few paces ahead of him. His eyes swept the room, and he was relieved to find the cleaner was no longer anywhere to be seen. The guards sprang to attention as the general strode out of the council chamber into the far corridor. Scott stared at the alarm button on the wall ahead of him.
Don't look around,
he begged under his breath as he kept his eyes on the retreating back of the general. With a yard to go before he reached the door, Scott lunged forward and jabbed his thumb on the red button. The doors immediately slammed, closed, and clamped with a deafening noise. Hannah was just about to push open the door that led to the back stairs when the alarm gave out a piercing sound and all the exits were immediately bolted. She turned to discover she was alone in the corridor with General Hamil and four of his Republican guards. The general smiled at her.
Miss Kopeck, I believe. I'm delighted to make your acquaintance. I fear it will be a couple of minutes before Professor Bradley is able to join us.
The guards surrounded Hannah as the general looked up at a television screen above the door. He watched as Scott, inside the chamber, pressed a button on the side of his watch. Scott then ran over to the wall, quickly extracted the copy of the document from the tube, and checked it against the original. He felt he had done a fair job back in the cab of the truck, but he spat on Lewis Morris and John Witherspoon for good measure, then spent a few seconds rubbing the parchment on the stone floor before comparing it once again to the one on the wall. He looked at his watch, 45 seconds. He began to pull the nails out of the wall, but was unable to get the top right-hand one to budge, so he eased the declaration over its head, 60 seconds. Hannah stared up at the television screen in horror, watching Simon undo all her work while the general made a phone call. Once Scott had removed the document from the wall, he placed it on the table. He then fastened the declaration that he had taken out of the cardboard cylinder back on the wall, easing the parchment over the nail in the top right-hand corner, which still stubbornly refused to budge. 90 seconds. He picked up Dollar Bill's copy from the table, rolled it up, and dropped it into the cylinder. 110 seconds. He walked over to the door that led to the elevators and stood inhaling deeply for a moment before the alarm stopped and the doors swung open. Scott knew that it would take them a few minutes before the source of the alarm could be checked, so when he saw the general, he shrugged his shoulders and smiled. Kratz sat on the front seat of the truck, keeping a wary eye on Major Saeed. There was a ringing sound. Saeed pressed a button and placed the phone to his ear. Suddenly, without warning, he turned, whipped out his pistol, and looked anxiously towards the cab. He barked out an order, and within seconds every soldier in sight surrounded the truck, their rifles pointing directly at Kratz. The major rushed up. "Where are the other two?" he demanded. Kratz shrugged his shoulders. Saeed turned on his heels and ran into the building, shouting another order as he went. Kratz placed his right hand over his left wrist and slowly began to unpeel the plaster, a second skin, secreted beneath his watch. He delicately removed the tiny green pill stuck to the plaster and transferred it to the palm of his hand. 60 or 70 eyes were staring at him. He began coughing, and slowly put his hand up to his mouth, lowered his head, and swallowed the pill. Saeed came rushing back out of the building and began barking new orders. Within seconds, a car pulled up beside the truck. "Out!" the major screamed at Kratz, who stepped down onto the tarmac and allowed a dozen fixed bayonets to guide him towards the back door of the car. He was pushed onto the seat, and two men in dark suits took a place on either side of him. One quickly turned him and tied his hands behind his back, while the other blindfolded him. Cohen and Aziz watched from the other side of the square as the car sped away from them. Chapter 31. The general returned Scott's smile.
"I won't introduce you to Miss Saeed," he said, "since I believe you've already met."
Scott looked blank as he stared at the woman dressed in a black abaya and a pushy that covered her face. She was surrounded by four soldiers, their bayonets drawn.
"We have a lot to thank Miss Saeed for, because, of course, it was she who led us to you in the first place. Now, to mention her postcard to Mrs. Rubin that helped you find the declaration so quickly, we did try to make it as easy as possible for you."
"I don't know, Miss Saeed," said Scott.
"Oh, come, Professor. Or should I call you Agent Bradley? I admire your gallantry, but while you may claim not to know Miss Saeed, you certainly know Hannah Kopek," the general said, as he ripped off Hannah's pushy.
Scott stared at Hannah, but still said nothing.
"Ah, I see you do remember her. But then it would be hard to forget someone who tried to kill you, wouldn't it?"
Hannah's eyes pleaded with Scott.
"How touching, my dear. He's forgiven you. But I fear I don't share his forgiving nature."
The general turned to see Major Saeed running towards him. He listened carefully to what the major whispered to him, then began banging his swagger stick rapidly against his long leather boots. "You're a fool!" he shouted at the top of his voice, and suddenly struck the major across the face with his swagger stick. He turned back to face Scott.
"It seems," he said, "that the reunion I had planned for you and your friends will have to wait a little longer, because although we have Colonel Kratz safely locked up, the Jew and the Kurdish traitor have escaped. But it can only be a matter of time before we catch them."
"How long have you known?" asked Hannah quietly.
"You made the mistake so many of our enemies make, Miss Kopek, of underestimating our great president," replied the general. "He dominates the affairs of the Middle East to a far greater extent than Gorbachev did the Russians, Thatcher the British, or Bush the American people. I ask myself how many citizens in the West any longer believe the Allies won the Gulf War. But then you were also stupid enough to underrate his cousin, Abdul Kanuk, our newly appointed ambassador to Paris. Perhaps he wasn't quite that stupid when he followed you all the way to your lover's flat and stood in a doorway the rest of the night before following you back to the embassy. It was he who informed our ambassador in Geneva what Miss Saeed was up to. Of course, we needed to be sure, not least because our deputy foreign minister found it so hard to accept such a tale about one of his most loyal members of staff. Such a naive man. So, when you came to Baghdad, the ambassador's wife invited Miss Saeed's brother to dinner. But sadly, he didn't recognize you. Your cover, as the more vulgar American papers would describe it, was blown. Those same papers keep asking pathetically, 'Why doesn't Mossad assassinate President Saddam?' If only they knew how many times Mossad has tried and failed.
what Colonel Kratz didn't tell you at your training school in Herzliya, Miss Kopik, was that you are the 17th Mossad agent who has attempted to infiltrate our ranks during the past 5 years, and all of them have experienced the same tragic end as your colonel is about to. And the real beauty of the whole exercise is that we don't have to admit we killed any of you in the first place. You see, the Jewish people are unwilling to accept, after Entebbe and Eichmann, that such a thing could possibly happen. I feel sure you will appreciate the logic of that, Professor.
I'll make a bargain with you, said Scott.
I'm touched, Professor, by your Western ethics. But I fear you have nothing to bargain with.
We'll trade Miss Saib if you release Hannah. The general burst out laughing.
Professor, you have a keen sense of the ridiculous. But I won't insult you by suggesting that you don't understand the Arab mind. Do allow me to explain. You will be killed, and no one will comment because, as I have already explained, the West is too proud to admit that you even exist. Whereas we in the East will throw our hands in the air and ask why Mossad has kidnapped a gentle, blameless secretary on her way to Paris and is now holding her in Tel Aviv against her will. We even know the house where she is captive. We have already arranged for sentimental pictures of her to be released to every paper in the Western world, and a distraught mother and son have been coached for weeks by one of your own public relations companies to face the Western press. We'll even have Amnesty International protesting outside Israeli embassies across the world on her behalf.
Scott stared at the general.
Poor Miss Saib will be released within days. Both of you, on the other hand, will die an unannounced, unheralded, and unmourned death. To think that all you sacrificed your lives for was a scrap of paper. And while we're on that subject, Professor, I will relieve you of the declaration.
The four soldiers stepped forward and thrust their bayonets at Scott's throat as the general snatched the cardboard tube from his grasp.
"You did well to switch the documents in 2 minutes, Professor," said the general, glancing up at the television screen above him. "But you can be assured that it remains our intention to burn the original very publicly on the 4th of July, and I feel confident that we will destroy President Clinton's flimsy reputation along with it." The general laughed. "You know, Professor, I have for many years enjoyed killing people. But I shall gain a particular pleasure from your deaths because of the appropriate way you will be departing this world."
The soldiers surrounded Hannah and Scott and forced them back into the chamber and on towards the short corridor. The general followed them down the passage. They all came to a halt in front of the open safe.
"Allow me," said General Hamil, "to inform you of one statistic you failed to mention, Professor, when you briefed me on this amazing feat of engineering. Perhaps you simply didn't know, although I am bound to admit that you have done your homework thoroughly. But did you realize that one person locked in a safe of this size, with a capacity of 504 cubic feet, can only hope to survive for 6 hours? I do not yet know the exact length of time